Hello, welcome to the Patient Activation Network podcast. I'm your host, Matt Cavallo, here with Dr. Barry Levitt, the author of the book, A Prescription for Success in Pharmaceuticals, Transforming a Startup into a Profitable, Cash-Producing Enterprise. Dr. Levitt, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, Matt.
Before we talk about the book, could you share a little bit about your background?
I went to medical school at the Downstate Medical Center in New York. I got my clinical training at the Mount Sinai Hospital in New York. And I went on to study pharmacology with a fellow who got the Nobel Prize in medicine. And after that, I went to Cornell, where I was an assistant professor of pharmacology. From there to New York Medical College in cardiology, where I became chief of cardiology, and I finally ended my academic career as vice chairman of the Department of Medicine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. So that's sort of a quick synopsis of my background. I should add one other small point. From 1970 to 1991, I was a consultant to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in cardiovascular diseases. So that was 21 years with the FDA.
So when you were on the floor as a cardiologist, what was that light switch that went off that said, I want to concentrate my practice in pharmacology?
I was always interested in therapeutic. To me, part of medicine is making patients better. In addition to the diagnostic side, I wanted to understand the therapeutic side. As an intern and a resident, we would make a diagnosis and then the chief would say, ask the nurse what the dose is. But, you know, the therapeutics of treating patients is as important as making the right diagnosis. So I got involved in therapeutics. I went back to Downstate when I finished my training in medicine. And I was, as I said, a postdoctoral fellow for Dr. Birchgard, who got the Nobel Prize in Medicine. And then I went to Cornell and spent a few years in pharmacology before going back to clinical medicine. But my inclination was always to understand the impact of drugs on people. And as a matter of fact, along with being chief of cardiology at New York Medical College, I was chief of clinical pharmacology, the study of how drugs work in people. And the same thing happened to me when I went to Albert Einstein. So to me, it was always important to focus on patients and what to do to make patients feel better, which is the reason for giving drugs in the first place.
I think that's such an important point because, you know, oftentimes when we think of pharmacology, we don't think about the patient experience and that all these treatments and the research that goes into it is really for the benefit of the quality of life of the patient. When I look at your background, how did that transition from pharmacology perspective into the FDA?
In 1970, the FDA was having a lot of trouble approving drugs for cardiovascular disease. And so they asked me to join as a consultant to help to break the logjam. And I must say I was quite successful by applying scientific methodology to the applications that we got from industry. I was able to help move a lot of drugs forward, obviously not alone because there's a whole team at the FDA, but it was a very rewarding experience to be able to move drugs from a paper application to watch them actually use and save lives in people. And in order to use drugs in the United States, you need approval from the FDA. So that was the vital link between research and clinical use was the regulatory piece, which made me understand how important the FDA is in protecting the American people and protecting patients. And it's true that it's a burden for industry, but it also helped. The FDA has helped to make industry better. It's helped to make the clinical trials better. And it's helped to sort of focus on what's necessary to make patients better. So it was a very good experience for me.
And then when you left the FDA, you went to Taro Pharmaceuticals.
That's correct.
What was your focus over there at Taro?
Well, Taro, when I joined Taro, it was a company that was operating principally in Israel. The company was not in good shape, to say the least. And I was supposed to be the guy to help to turn it around. I became chairman of Taro in 91, and I was able to improve the company. I was able to increase its sales from $8 to $10 million a year to $400 million a year. And actually, the company, when I was there, had a market cap of $2 billion. Now it's more than $4 billion. So it was really a success story, but it was a success story based on two things. First of all, applying good, solid science to drug development. And also, at least during the time I was at Taro, we tried to focus on making drugs that were not only approvable from the FDA, but also affordable for patients. That's not to say it was simple. I mean, I make it sound like, oh, I just came in and I was like the savior of the company. In the book, I outline all the things I did wrong. And in retrospect, in writing the book and then in reading the book, I realized how many things I did wrong. And part of writing the book was to make sure that the next guy who's got to save a pharmaceutical company doesn't have to make all my mistakes, that the next guy can learn from my mistakes and not start from zero. Because the whole business of pharmaceuticals and pharmaceutical marketing is complicated. I describe that in the book.
And we're talking to Dr. Barry Levitt, the author of the book, A Prescription for Success in Pharmaceuticals, Transforming a Startup into a Profitable Cash-Producing Enterprise. What was your inspiration for writing this book?
I guess the inspiration, first of all, was to describe exactly what I said in the subtitle of the book, how to transform a startup, which was a cash-consuming enterprise, and turn it into a cash-producing profitable enterprise. And I guess that is the goal of every entrepreneur who would like to take a startup and convert it into a successful business. So that was my inspiration, the first inspiration. But as a secondary inspiration, I felt it was important to make the public aware of all of the complications that go into the pricing of drugs and how those prices, starting from the manufacturer, are transformed as they get to the patient. Not a one-to-one relationship. It's not like you buy a pair of shoes and the shoe manufacturer says this will cost $100 and then the patient will pay $102 because he's got to pay something to the guy who's selling the shoes. It's a very much more complicated problem. And I think, given the problems of healthcare in the United States today, it was something that was very important. According to the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, in 2015, the United States spent $3.1 trillion on health care, of which more than 10%, or $310 billion, in that one year was spent on prescription drugs. So if we want to make the cost of health care less expensive in the United States and more affordable for patients, then it's important to find productive, reasonable ways to lower the cost of drugs for patients.
Those are mind-blowing statistics. Let's talk about prescription drug prices, because the book goes into depth on prescription drug prices and the tangled web that it weaves. Could you expand on that a little bit?
Sure. If you start from the very beginning, there are two opposing forces in the case of drug prices. For patients, it's very important to have the lowest possible price. For drug companies, it's very important to have the highest possible price. And those are seemingly irreconcilable forces. And in between are a number of intermediaries who also participate in they add service in terms of bringing a drug from a pharmaceutical manufacturer to a patient, but they also add cost. So we have to find solutions that work for patients, but don't bankrupt the pharmaceutical industry and don't bankrupt the wholesaler and the retailer that we need. Because when you're sick and you need a medicine, it's very handy to be able to go to the corner drugstore and get it. And in order to do that, somebody has got to inventory the drug, somebody has got to move it to the pharmacy so that it's there when you need. When we talk about the cost of drugs and things that affect the cost of drugs, I guess you can divide it into two broad categories. There are costs or prices that relate to pharmaceutical manufacturers, who incidentally are the usual villains. If you go to a political rally, it's the drug companies, they're the bad guys. On the other hand, the other costs of pharmaceuticals are the costs between the manufacturer and the patient. Well, let's start with the pharmaceutical manufacturer. There are several factors that make it possible for drug companies to charge high prices. First, the monopolies that the U.S. government has put in place. The first of those are patents. So during the course of a patent, only the patent holder can market the drug. And so the patent holder has effectively got a monopoly. In addition to that monopoly, and some of the monopolies that are now much more apparent in the news, is the orphan drug monopoly. And if you develop, you being a pharmaceutical manufacturer, develop a drug for an orphan disease, a disease with fewer than 200,000 people that suffer from that disease, the Food and Drug Administration gives you 5 years of administrative protection. During that time, they will not accept an application from a competing manufacturer. So that's 7 years during which prices can go sky high, and we've seen them go sky high. And the second government, U.S. government, created monopoly is a monopoly under Hatch-Waxman, where in certain circumstances, generic drugs are given up to 6 months of exclusivity if they're the first ones to challenge a patent. So you have this whole area in which the government itself is responsible for creating an environment for higher prices. The government created that problem. I think the government needs to do something to solve the problem. But besides that, there are other factors that are government related, and that is A, the Food and Drug Administration. Sometimes the Food and Drug Administration sets clinical trial goals that are so difficult that new drugs can't get through, which is a situation that I found when I joined the FDA in 1970. And then there are times when the FDA will establish chemical or analytical barriers so that more than one company may not be able to get through. And finally, there are shortages of drugs. So what happens when companies drop out for lack of profitability, and I'll get to that in just 1 second, you find yourself in a situation either where there's an oligopoly or a monopoly, where there's only one person, one company that makes a particular drug. And if it happens to fall into the hands of someone unscrupulous, and we've seen that happen in the last week where someone went to jail for this kind of behavior. So you're in a situation where the unfortunate patients are exposed to really excessive prices. Now you'd say, well, why do companies drop out to produce shortages? Well, one of the things that strikes me, and which I went into great detail in the book, was this relationship between price and profit for a pharmaceutical company. And I describe a mathematical, that's a parabola that's created. If you charge an infinitely high price for a drug, you're not going to sell any drug because nobody has an infinite amount of money to spend, and so you won't make any profit. On the other hand, if you charge an infinitely low price for a drug, well, you'll sell an awful lot and you won't make any profit. As a matter of fact, you might lose money. So it frequently is beneficial to pharmaceutical companies to sell less than the maximum amount, but to do it at a high enough price so that they have profit. Now, the thesis of generic drugs has been that if you have multiple companies competing for a single drug, they will continually lower prices and make less and less and less expensive drugs for patients. The problem is that you reach a point of diminishing returns where the company starts losing money, and when they lose money, they drop out. And so you end up with only a few companies or maybe only one company left, and so the exposure to much higher prices. And in fact, in the book, I described that happened to us because of the very complicated environment between the pharmaceutical manufacturer and the patient. We actually found ourselves selling a drug below our cost, and it's obvious that we were able to sell an awful lot, but we're also able to lose an awful lot of money. And until we realized it and stopped selling the drug, we did lose a lot of money. So as a pharmaceutical company, there's a balance. Now, it's true that George Merck, the founder of Merck, said, the drugs are for the patients, the profits will follow. But you need to have profits to keep a drug company going. You need to have cash to meet your payroll. You need to have profit to do research. And both the patient who wants the lowest possible price and the drug company that wants the highest possible price, they both, I guess, can agree on one thing. It's important to move the needle of science forward, to develop new drugs, to develop new treatments in order to make patients feel better and live longer. And they do live longer now. So there is no question that the overall society has been successful at whatever the pain is in prolonging life and improving health.
So when you noticed that you were selling this treatment below cost, was there any kind of pricing correction that occurred, or did you have to drop out at that point and allow the generics to enter the market? How's that look from a company standpoint?
We were, as a matter of fact, in that situation. I guess the part that I didn't really talk about today, and I spend a lot of time discussing and describing in the book, is that web of complications between a manufacturer and a patient. And we got caught in that web. When a pharmaceutical company sells a drug, let's say for $100, to a wholesaler, and the wholesaler makes a deal with the large chain of drugstores to sell the drug to them for $50, what happens is that the wholesaler charges the pharmaceutical company back for $50. So the wholesaler basically loses nothing. Pharmaceutical company has sold something in effect for $50, not $100, but all of the cash discounts, the promotions, rebates, etc., are associated with the $100 cost. And so the pharmaceutical company is punished. Now, these chargebacks associated with other price concessions that you make in order to compete, and the goal of a generic pharmaceutical company is to get its product onto the shelf of a pharmacy, because it's only if it's on the shelf of a pharmacy that it will be dispensed in response to a patient's prescription, so a doctor's prescription. So it becomes very important to get the drug onto the shelf of the pharmacy. And to do that, all kinds of deals are made for every drug with all of the different intermediary functions in the supply chain. The sad thing is that many of these concessions, these competitive concessions that one company uses to advantage their drug at the expense of competitors' drugs, many of these concessions never get to the patient. So the patient is still paying a high price. It would be much better for everyone if there were transparency in the whole pricing situation from when a manufacturer sells a drug to the time it gets to a patient. And if there was a simplification of the structure, so there wouldn't be a tangled web, and that would be better for manufacturers because they'd make more money, and better for patients, because they'd pay less money. So one of the points that I make in the book with respect to legislature, I'm talking about the Congress, that before you start legislating about the price of drugs, be it price controls or various other maneuvers, it's important to understand the entirety of the problem. It's easy to criticize the president of Merck for high drug prices, and he was criticized today by the president, but that doesn't solve the problem. The problem only gets solved if, in addition to the prices that the manufacturer puts on his product, are all the other add-ons that go into a drug or the cost of a drug from the time it leaves the manufacturer to the time it gets to the patient. And it's all about patients. The end of the story is it's all about patients.
And one of the things I love about this book is that you go into a historical background about how this pricing problem started, going back to the 60s and President Nixon. Do you see, with the tangled history that occurred with pharmaceutical pricing, do you see an era where we can get to pricing transparency?
Well, first of all, it was Nixon in 1971. He put price controls on everything and just took it off pharmaceuticals last. But the problem was that after that, there was an anticipation that he would put price controls back on in order to control inflation. So everybody priced their drug at the highest possible level so that if price controls were put back on, they would be frozen at high prices. And the way they competed with each other was by giving discounts. It's like when you go to buy a car and you got the manufacturer's suggested retail price. But if you buy the car from me, I'll give you a $100 rebate, or I won't charge you any interest for 5 years or whatever. So there was this whole mechanism of keeping prices high and giving price concessions that got into the pharmaceutical business. And then it turned out to be in the best interests of a lot of the various factors in the pharmaceutical industry to keep it that way. So unraveling it is difficult. But it's clear that whoever tries to unravel this tangled web has to understand everything, both the reasons for the high prices at manufacturers and the complications of getting a drug from a manufacturer to a patient. And one of the things that made it possible for me to describe and discuss this in the book is that I have no horse in the race anymore. I'm not involved in the pharmaceutical industry. So I would never have been able to write this when I was in the pharmaceutical industry, because nobody would have bought any drugs from us. So having been out of the business for 7 years, I felt free to tell what I know. And hopefully what I know will be helpful to those people who have to make the decisions about legislation.
It's really interesting because you have the perspective from not only the pharmacology entrepreneurial side, but also that legal and regulatory background, which is such a great blend in this book. If you had to give some advice to entrepreneurs, what would that be that are getting into the market today?
Well, my first piece of advice is understand the market, because if you don't understand the market, you're going to make a lot of mistakes. All of the different people in the market in our capitalist society, they're all interested in making a profit. And you can't hold it against them, because you, the entrepreneur, are interested in making a profit also. So you have to understand all the forces at play, because if you don't, you'll end up like we did, and you'll end up losing an awful lot of money until you figure out the right way to conduct the business. So first start by understanding the business, which is pretty much what you do in science. The first thing you do when you're starting a project is you read the literature. You read all the patents that have been issued on the subject and try to make yourself as educated as you possibly can be before you start your project. So that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, as a kind of a handbook or a blueprint that somebody could read and educate themselves very quickly. As a matter of fact, at the back of the book, I describe all of the laws that impact the pharmaceutical industry. I'm not an attorney, so I'm not sure that I've described the laws very accurately, but certainly someone getting into the business would be able to learn in the space of a few hours what took me 15 years to learn. So I tried to make it easy. And I also, in the back of the book, I listed all of the things we used to take into account in selecting targets, drug targets for development, and all the things you have to know before you start a research project.
As we're starting to wind down and close out this podcast, do you have any closing thoughts for somebody who's thinking about purchasing this book?
I think that this book represents a kind of a primer, not just for people who are getting into the pharmaceutical business, but are getting into almost any kind of business, because a lot of the same problems that we had in pharmaceuticals, they have in the food industry, you have in any regulated industry, and even a non-regulated industry. And a lot of the problems that we had were not related just to pharmaceuticals, but they were related to business as a whole. So I think that it's a good starting point, rather than making your own mistakes, to learn from my mistakes. And I think I outlined my mistakes in a fair amount of detail.
Dr. Barry Levitt, the author of A Prescription for Success in Pharmaceuticals, Transforming a Startup into a Profitable Cash-Producing Enterprise. Dr. Levitt, thank you so much for joining us here today. You shared such great information that I'm sure is helpful to people that are getting into pharmaceuticals today. Where can my listeners find this book?
You can find it on Amazon.
Amazon, BarnesandNobles.com, and iTunes as well, correct?
Sure, that's correct.
I just wanted to make sure that I highlighted that for our listeners. And I wanted to thank you so much for your time today. It's been very insightful.
I appreciate the opportunity to be with you, Matt.
Well, thank you all so much for tuning in to the Patient Activation Network podcast. I'm Matt Cavallo, and thanks to Dr. Barry Levitt for sharing his time with us. And tune in next time for another inspirational story.